Great to have you with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, Larry Mueller here. Happy to have you along today as we take a look at the wonderful world of Wisconsin wildlife with Scott Craven, UW wildlife ecologist. Back once again. Great to have him here. It's kind of a week late. Well, normally you're the first Wednesday of the month, and where are we? In the middle of the month, but...
Really? I thought this was the first... Well, I don't remember what my lame excuse was. Where was I? Oh, board meeting for the land trust. I was up north. Okay.
You're in northern Wisconsin, so you're excused, and we had a good show. And I know we're going to have a good show today. We got lots of things that we can talk about. I know you wanted to correct something from the last show, and maybe we could do that right away, relating to acorn storage.
Yeah, it was a little bit of additional information. I remember a woman called at the last program and said, wow, this is weird. These woodpeckers are drilling holes in the house tree or whatever and then stuffing acorns in there. And we talked a little bit about that being common behavior with some Western species like the appropriately named acorn woodpecker. But it turns out that I was so informed when I returned to the office that, hey, apparently red-bellied woodpeckers will do this on occasion. Mm-hmm. How they figure whether they talked to their Western relatives and figured it out, I don't know how or why, but it's a whole lot easier to explain that behavior with a local woodpecker that's caught on than with a rare species that could have been here but probably wasn't. So probably a red-bellied woodpecker.
Probably a red-bellied woodpecker. Well, what about white Canada geese? Jennifer posted on Facebook about that the other day, and I know... There can be, certainly there have been white Canada geese spotted, albinos. They'd have to be pink-eyed, I think, to be an albino.
Yeah, I mean, an albino is certainly possible, but...
Not very likely.
You know, I spent all my graduate days for 2 degrees for 7 years looking at hundreds of thousands of geese across the flyway and across Canada, and have never seen an albino, but I've seen a number of hybrids, which... can be mostly white.
Yeah.
And of course there are white geese too. So I guess I don't want to disclaim Jennifer's observation, but I guess I'd like to know a little more about the circumstances. Was it with a family group or a flock of Canadas?
It was with a flock of Canadas.
Okay, well, you know, then all we can say is that it does happen. But if the question is how common is it, it's very unusual.
And we had a great picture of an owl sent in. Jill, I believe, caught this owl in Oconto County yesterday.
That's a nice owl.
Yeah, I'm trying to think of what kind. Is it?
I think it's a barred owl.
Is it a barred, do you think?
Mm-hmm.
It's a beautiful owl. This is all on our Facebook page, by the way. So go to the Larry Mueller Show, and you're going to see some wonderful photos, including another one.
The deer is pretty cool.
The deer is really cool. Neil sent this in. There was a family of deer lost in the... Alaska waters is swimming around, and a boat was passing by, and the deer swam to the boat, and they got him on the boat.
Apparently it was a good idea on the deer's part.
Yeah.
And I imagine that water was mighty cold.
Yeah, and the youngest of the family got, once they got her to the, got him to the shore, they put the youngest one in a wheelbarrow and wheeled it. That's pretty cool.
I see the follow-up question there is how often do deer take to the water, and I'd say very often. I've seen them swimming in lakes in northern Wisconsin. They routinely cross to and from islands in the Wisconsin River. Water's really not a big obstacle, but if you lose your way in the fog or whatnot off the coast of Alaska, you better hope there's a fishing boat nearby if you're a deer.
Yeah, if you're a deer.
And on the owl subject, since that nice picture came up, I should just point out, I'm surprised we haven't seen a snowy owl picture because apparently this is shaping up to be a good winter for a snowy owl invasion, and people always get a kick out of seeing those really spectacular owls. So.
Yep, and speaking of sightings or not sightings, Mary Facebooked us, sent us a message on Facebook, and there were deer on our land in Jackson County, but I didn't see a deer all season long. Some were close enough that I could hear them, but except for the chickadees, nuthatches, and pygmy shrews, that's about all there was to break up the silence of a very long but beautiful deer season.
Well, Mary, I'm sorry you didn't see any deer. I can only say that your comment is not, you're not alone.
No, you're not.
I don't remember. I mean, it's a very... a very disconcerting thing for me and difficult to explain how many people in how many places simply say they are just either not seeing any deer or not seeing nearly as many deer as they used to or a variety of other laments. And I have to say that I hunted in four counties, and at least in three of those spots, I'd have to agree with the same thing. So I don't know. It's a peculiar situation. Weather plays a role, deer behavior, the extended seasons in the southern part of the state. Some people claim deer have gone nocturnal and they're really hard to find or see. I don't have a good explanation, but I can only say that I've had more comments like that this year than ever before.
Yeah, there, and certainly in northern parts of northern Wisconsin, where we hunted, not a whole lot of deer there.
Well, and you know, some of that's been, typically that's been the case in the far north. There were some aberrations there over years when we had successive and numerous mild winters, but seems to be back to the status quo in some places.
But nevertheless, there was a pretty good kill. The harvest was...
There was. It was up a bit. I'm just looking for my statistics here so I don't get this all wrong. But the overall total... this is for the 9-day season now. Lots of precincts have not reported. In other words, there's still the muzzleloader season, the December antlerless season, the holiday hunt coming up in the southern part of the state. In CWD land, the archery kill is not finalized yet. So the number will go way up for total deer killed over all opportunities. But for the 9-day season, which most people tend to think of as, hey, this is the deer season, the take was just over 226,000, which was up slightly from the 221 in 2010. And there were some more dramatic differences. For example, in the southern part of the state, where are my numbers here? In the chronic wasting disease area, the buck kill was up 35%, the doe kill was down 28%, and I think the total was off by a few percentage points from previous years. Now, I know people called me and some legislators called and said, wow, this is really bizarre. What about all these bucks? And I said, well, no huge surprise.
No.
Earn a buck went away for the first time in years, at least for the first animal. So the buck harvest was at least in my little part of the world in Iowa County, it was spectacular. Mm-hmm. When I registered my deer on Saturday morning, the opening morning, there were a dozen or 15 trucks lined up at the registration station, and it was just a sea of antlers and big antlers. I mean, I saw more deer standing there in 10 minutes, more big deer that would have attracted a crowd and photographs and backslapping and whatnot in years gone by. They seem to be the norm. And that's a reflection of this regulations change. Earn a buck, like it or not like it, or love it or leave it, or it's gone or it isn't. Clearly stockpiled some older age class bucks on the landscape in CWD land, and those deer,
they're gone. Now they're
well,
gone.
I don't know if they're gone. I hope they're not. I hope they're not gone completely, because that was a big attraction to keep hunters in the woods. But a lot of really big deer were taken, and it was just spectacular to see.
By the way, I should give the phone number again, because I haven't done that in a long time. If you have a question or comment for our guest today, Scott Craven, I hope you'll join us. What kind of wildlife have you been noticing lately? Are there seeing more or less than other years? Have you had a look at the whitetail in your area? What do you think? Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. Email at talk@wpr.org. Or go to my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show, and you can post a comment there.
There was one other interesting take on the deer harvest that I think particularly for people who don't hunt, but, you know, hear about these numbers. So you hear a number, 225,000 or whatever. It seems like a big number, but Pat Durkin had an interesting column, an outdoor writer. And
That's a good writer.
He calculated that for the legal shooting hours during the 9-day season, a deer was dropping in Wisconsin about every 1.1 seconds, and on an opening weekend, it was quite a bit more rapid than that. So that's kind of an interesting way to look at it. A deer per second or less throughout daylight hours is pretty impressive. That's why it's such a big deal in this state.
Absolutely. Well, we have callers online who want to visit with you, so I suppose we should go to the phones. Terry in Green Bay, we turn to you. Hi, Terry.
Good morning. Thank you for the call.
Sure.
Got some pheasants that we have in a pen, and something's getting in and killing the roosters and just leaving them lay. And trying to figure out what that might be. I had my grandson hunting, and we did see about a 90% white weasel with some brown spots on it, maybe a half a mile to the north of where we have the pen pheasants.
So could you tell how they were killed? Was there a bite to the head or any blood? No, just, they were just dead.
They were just dead.
But no evidence that they'd been...
They weren't mauled or picked or pecked apart or anything.
Do you still have any of them?
No, this was probably just before deer season. So
okay.
We're looking at... And the netting on the pheasant pen, because of the heavy snowfall, we have to go back and do some repair before we can replenish our
supply.
Well, yeah, supply, yeah. So we let all those go with on the property, so they weren't being killed in the pen.
Okay. Well, the most likely culprit when poultry of any kind, be it pheasants or chickens, are mass killed like that, is a member of the weasel family.
Yeah.
But probably not the weasel you saw a half mile away. They don't range that far. But if it was anywhere, were the pens anywhere within a quarter of a mile or so of any water?
Oh, yeah. We're on the Lemonware River, so we're probably, very close to.
Okay. Well, we're not going to know for sure, but my suspicion is that Mr. Mink might have been involved. From the river, or any other member of the weasel family, long-tail weasel, short-tail weasel, even rats will sometimes kill poultry, although that's a little less likely. You'd see other sign of them around. If the birds are disturbed and flying up into the netting, horned owls will sometimes kill them, but the head's often gone. That's why I asked about what the evidence was. But the weasels will kill large numbers of birds like that, usually with a bite to the back of the head. And that's why I asked if you had any of them to maybe skin out that area and actually determine how they were killed might shed some light on it. But
we'll do that.
If it happens again, check that and check your security in the pens. Change your lower your mesh size as small as you can get. And you might want to have somebody who knows a bit about trapping do a little weasel trapping around your pens.
Yep.
All right. Thank you.
Good luck.
Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. Jason in La Crosse, your turn. Hi, Jason.
Hi. I wanted to talk a little bit about the behavior of deer, especially, as soon as the 9-day season opened. My brother-in-law, his family owns quite a bit of land within La Crosse County, and every single day that I know for 3 months before the season, he'd go out, set up cameras, and he'd film some beautiful buck. I mean, just huge young adult, and so there were a lot of prospects of, well, these two are going to be there. They were in the same spot every single day, each time of day. As soon as the season opened and he went out there, they were nowhere to be found, naturally.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of the stories are the same, the small talk in bars and such, where they see them every single day before hunting season starts, and then even though they're the first ones in the field thereafter, they're not found.
Mm-hmm.
And a few of them have actually speculated that CWD has somehow given them a memory or a calendar as to when they're going to start shooting. So generally, he hasn't seen such bad luck in the years before. But, yeah, it's definitely a big thing, not only in Wisconsin, but I have family up in the Twin Cities that, have hunted their entire lives, and it's the same thing. They're all desperate to find that piece of land that they're all at.
Yeah.
Well, Jason, as you said, a lot of people are singing from the same page on the hymnal here, especially with the tremendous use of trail cameras now. These big deer are seen. They're clearly alive and out there. But when it comes to actually harvesting one, that's a tough proposition. They didn't get to be 4.5 or 5.5 or 6.5 by being unwary. So when the hunting season starts and all those folks are in the woods, I don't think it takes many shots. I don't think it takes a great deal of human-centered disruption before those deer simply head for the thickest possible cover they can find. And they know their home just the way you know everything in your home. And they're out of sight and out of harm's way. Now, they do occasionally make a mistake. or they're forced to make a mistake. In my own case, on opening morning, I was heading up to get my son on his deer stand, and I knew where he was. And in fact, I could see him up on the ridgetop, but I also knew there was a really thick patch of prickly ash between he and me, and we had seen very little. So I said, "Okay, I'm gonna take one. I'm gonna take one for the team here and crash into that brush." And I hadn't gone 50 feet, and all of a sudden, kawham! And I knew that was a good thing. And when I got up to the top of the hill, there was my son with a big smile on his face, and there was a 4.5-year-old buck that we'd certainly never seen before, with kind of an odd rack of antlers, 11 points. It was a beautiful animal. And he said, as soon as I stepped into that brush, the deer came slowly creeping up the hill, looking back all the time over its shoulder to see what I was doing, and walked right into him. And boom, it was gone. Had he not been sitting there, or had the deer had another 100 yards to operate, I'm sure we'd have never seen it. So,
Or had you not walked in?
Or had I not walked into the brush, it probably wouldn't have left that patch of brush for the duration of the hunting opportunity. So sometimes people get lucky, but deer clearly do, especially the older bucks, adapt very quickly. And also people are talking about them becoming much more nocturnal, so they're seen in night photographs when they're active, but not during the day. It's the way it is, and it makes for some challenging hunting, if that's your target.
Thanks for calling. Scott Craven, UW Wildlife Ecologist. Our guest, I'm Larry Mueller. Judith Sears-Poisson, our producer on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Scott Craven, UW Wildlife Ecologist, our guest today here as we talk about the wonderful world of Wisconsin wildlife. Scott, you had another deer story, I think, is a pretty good one, and instructive too.
Well, it's related to what the to what Jason was talking about. As you know, we live just outside Madison, not in a rural area, but not wilderness by any means. There are plenty of houses around and lots of a few acres to, we have 12 acres of prairie grass. And it turns out the prairie grass is apparently a good spot for these deer to simply lie down and stay out of harm's way. We haven't seen, or I haven't seen, a live deer during the day around our property or anything in the neighbor's alfalfa field for probably 6 months. So we put out the trail camera on our walking trail, 50 yards from the back door during the deer season. And not only did we see a few does coming and going, but there was a very strange looking buck that was missing one half of his rack. He had a 4-point rack on one side and two probably 10-inch tall brow tines that were forked.
Wow.
So he looked right at the camera on one occasion and said, "That is a strange-looking animal." But he'd have been a 12-pointer had he had the other beam, and a pretty nice deer. No one that I know in the neighborhood has ever seen that animal alive. And for the time we had the trail camera out, he was there every morning between 5:30 and 5:45 on the trail. The deer season ended on Sunday night. On Monday morning, Candy took the dogs out. That deer was standing in the front yard. At 9 o'clock in the morning. Now,
how they know?
How do they know? It's kind of creepy, but it's neat to know that they're out there, even though you're not necessarily tripping over them every time you go outside.
Tom in Ojibwa, on to you. Hi, Tom.
Yes, I've got a question about the timber wolves. We run cattle, about 197 head. We've lost 12 head to timber wolves. Our deer count around us is extremely down, and the same thing. How much effect is there? They tell us there's supposed to be about 300 head of timber wolves in Wisconsin. They say or figure there's close to 1,400 to 1,500. How many deer are being killed by them? I cannot take my answer off phone.
Okay.
Well, Tom, I'm sorry to hear about the loss of your cattle to wolves. That's a very distressing problem for a variety, many reasons, but the biggest one is that these animals should not any longer be on the endangered species list.
Right.
And until our congressional people and the DNR and a number of other resource agencies can get this taken care of, And it's not the Wisconsin folks. The Wisconsin folks at the legislative and DNR level want these animals off the endangered species list, in which case they can start to do more for people like you to stop these depredations. That's sort of a sidebar. The issue of the deer kill, and Larry can speak to this too, because his hunting area in Bayfield County is in the midst of a pack territory.
Yep.
It may not be so much that the wolves are actually killing and eating all the deer or a substantial portion of them. I think in part it's a matter of the deer simply trying to avoid a known wolf territory where wolf pack is very active. Either way, there are pockets of habitat across the northern two-thirds of Wisconsin now where wolves are active and, relatively speaking, numerous, where deer numbers are quite low.
Yeah.
In terms of how many they actually eat, even if we had 1,000, the count is for last winter was estimated at around 780 animals. Let's say there were 1,000. Most of the literature that's out on how many deer, if wolves ate only deer, how many deer does a wolf need to subsist on in the course of a year is something less than 20. So even if we had 1,000 wolves in the winter, which we don't, it's 20,000 deer, which stacks up probably less than what we're killing with motor vehicles on the state's roads. So in the bigger scheme of things, it's not a huge number. But for a local area like your property or where Larry hunts or your hunting camp where, gee, there seems to be a lot of wolf activity, it can be a very significant local impact. So
There you go. We had an email from Larry in Stevens Point. I'm wondering if, Scott, if you're willing to comment on Dr. Deer. I've heard, Larry says, I've heard two public broadcasting interviews with the Deer Czar. Is he as good as and well-known as he claims to be? I have a hard time thinking that an outside person can do any better for Wisconsin than our DNR people. Seems like a waste of $125,000.
Well.
What do you think of that?
Well, Dr. James Kroll is pretty well known in some deer circles. The two people that he's aligned himself with as part of his team to do this review of the deer program, David Gwynn from Clemson and Gary Ault, formerly from Pennsylvania, now in California, are also both very well known and known for different aspects of deer management. So collectively, it's a pretty good team. You know, they did bring different things to the table. I agree with emailer, was it Larry, I guess, who said, well, you know, there's some concern over spending $125,000 hard-earned sportsmen's or state's dollars for this. There are many competent deer managers in Wisconsin, in the agency and out. Only time will tell whether the money's well spent and whether something is suggested that does some good. Anyone who's followed the deer situation, if you go way back to Leopold's days in the 40s, when he was struggling with the deer management issues and hunting does and whatnot, for some reason there is a periodic unrest among Wisconsin deer hunters and the deer hunting community, and the result is some type of soul searching, whether it was the Deer 2000 public initiative, whether it was a variety of different task forces and study groups we've had over the years. Something happens, and this issue of having a deer trustee or a deer committee oversee things is just yet another example of that. I don't know what they're going to come up with, but my hope is that whatever they come up with, that it has some durability so we can achieve some level of stability in deer regulations and deer hunting in the state and don't have to go through this periodic upheaval when everybody's mad at everybody else and seemingly unhappy. When we still were killing a deer a second, it's pretty good deer hunting in the state overall, and all those trophy bucks we saw at the registration station. There have to be some happy people out there. Happy people. It's time to speak up and tell this deer committee what you think is good about the situation, and if they can shed some light on maybe where some tweaking can be done, maybe we can get on with our lives, because it's there are too many distractions that take away from what otherwise is a fantastic opportunity to hunt deer in the state of Wisconsin.
We have Mike and Racine with a, I think, a question related to what we've been discussing here the last 5 minutes or so. So let's go to Mike. Hi, Mike.
Hi. You know, I listened to the caller from Ojibwe. My deer hunting area is in the Russ County area, not actually that far away from Ojibwe. But the concern that I have is that, it, or not, I don't know if it's a concern, but, you know, I understand that the localization of timber wolf impacts and so forth, but I'm just wondering if we aren't getting a lot of bad press for the timber wolf in some of these areas, when really I'm going to propose that the bad actor is actually the black bear. I know in the area, the specific land that we hunt, old family farm, we rent the fields out to a local farmer, and most of the people in the area do similar. Either they're farmers themselves or they lease their land out to one of the grain farmers in the area. And, you know, I just ran into the guy that rents our fields here just 2 days ago in the coffee shop up there, up near Holcomb. And he let me know that, you know, because I asked him how the deer hunt went for them and so forth. He let me know that, hey, you know, the reason why, as I was saying, we hadn't seen a lot of does and fawns, and he goes, well, you know what that is. This is in the section right around where you're at there, where he's got a lot of his grain fields, between the DNR trapping because of crop complaints and then his own crop damage tags, within less than of a section of an area, mm-hmm. they took out 36 bears, mm-hmm. and all of them were adults. They were all 100 pounds, anywhere from 100 pounds up to 600 pounds. Well, if you get a section, you got a wildlife ecologist there. I need to tell you that the range for a wild black bear doesn't suggest any. I don't know how you can, other than saying you're having a party, a bear party, why you would have that many number of bears in a managed situation in that small of an area.
Yeah,
and there's some of these areas up closer to Sauk County line, which is up in the Ojibwe space. I know a couple of big property owners up there, and they're talking, you know, for every deer they see on the, or for every four or five deer they see on the trail cam, they see a bear.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
they got two or three cubs with them.
Well, yeah. There's no question about that, Mike, and I think you're absolutely right. First of all, there are many times more bears than wolves. People tend to finger the wolf, perhaps just because of holdover, you know, the big bad wolf mindset. But there are many more bears. They're very efficient predators on fawns in particular. And I think there are two things here that will shed some light on this. Number one, the DNR is in the process of replicating the 2008 study that gave us a bear population estimate quite a bit higher than what we had prior to that. That's being redone, and I think will be redone again. So we'll have a really good estimate of how many bears there really are out there. And number two, they're in the midst of an extensive research project on fawn mortality due to predation. And if we put those two things together and the results are available over the next year or two or whatever, we'll have a clearer picture of what's going on. Now, I won't speculate on what's going to happen, but let's say for the sake of discussion that bears are fingered, holy moly, this is a huge leak in the bucket that we hadn't considered earlier or hadn't taken into account in the management strategy. What would then be done? Or could be done, I'm not so sure. But nevertheless, we should at least know. But I think you're right. And don't forget, besides the bears and the wolves, we have a very healthy coyote population. And I've got landowners on whose property I hunt here in the southern part of the state who, because of their trail camera work, pin a fair bit of blame on fawn recruitment problems on coyotes. So there are lots of things out there that eat deer besides people, and eventually we'll have to sort this all out, and hopefully it will it'll all be a piece of the puzzle here that the deer trustee group gives us a report on, and we'll move forward.
Thanks again for calling. I want to go back to our Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show, and here's another photo, pretty cool one. From Bernie in Velders, my friends and I are debating whether a deer did this, and a photo of a tree that's down. What you can't see in this shot is that the log that broke off on the ground is completely raked flat on the side. And it is a pretty interesting picture. Oops. So we're looking at it right now. So what could it have been? Broke off at the ground, flat on the side to what would have been 6 inches or more before it fell. I've seen two or three more like this in previous years. So that does not, to me, look like a rub.
No, it looks like something was working on that.
It's almost more like a beaver than
you could have a very extensive rub. That's a good sized tree for rub, so you'd think it was a good sized deer. But never in the case of any buck rub activity have I ever seen any shavings or fibrous material like that, because they're essentially just polishing things up, not necessarily shredding it. From my angle here, at least on the computer screen, the picture's kind of dark. I guess I'd like to see another picture or two or get a measure of the size of that thing. But it looks like if the tree was dead.
Trying to get it back.
Is that another picture of the same thing? Or is that looked like
a
beaver?
That was a beaver, I think.
Yeah, that's a beaver. Definitely beaver. I don't know what to say about that. It is an interesting picture. Usually when there's a big pile of wood shreds and fibers anywhere near a tree, that's the kind of thing I'd expect to see beneath a snag that a pileated woodpecker's working on. But that doesn't look like a really dead snag there. So
no.
I'm not sure what to say about that one, Larry.
Don't know what we can do about that one. Patricia in Madison, let's go to you next. Hi, Patricia.
Hi. There are several bills before the Senate and Assembly that take hunter-trapper control of the Natural Resources Board and the Secretary and push trapping into all of our stewardship lands as a prerequisite of purchase. And I can tell you from being on the Trapping Committee of the Conservation Congress that if you put trapping into all of our public lands 4.5 months in the winter, there will be no fur bearers left. There will be no wildlife left because they're vulnerable in winter and they will be attracted from miles around to that bait. And they are already destroying so many beavers in the state that there's hardly anything left according to their own statistics. That's for Trout Unlimited to stock trout. And beavers create the most valuable habitat in the world for endangered. Half of the species need that habitat to survive. So, this is a disaster. If hunters are going to control all of our political process for putting trapping and hunting into killing out all of our wildlife and all of our public lands, we have 3 million wildlife watchers who are going to be deprived of any interaction with wildlife, which is pretty much where it's headed worldwide.
Scott, what do you think?
Well, I understand the concern about some of these uses on public properties where the idea of reducing the populations aside, there can be conflicts from some of these uses on public lands when people are nervous about walking their dogs or they know there are traps set, for example. So there are some resource user conflicts that are valid, and those are generally taken into account. The notion that the populations are going to be decimated just doesn't wash. If you think about this for a minute, what are the animals that are most seemingly most abundant or had historic population highs right now across the country? Wild turkeys, white-tailed deer, Canada geese. The duck population is the highest it's been in 55 years. These are all animals that are extensively and intensively hunted. So something doesn't add up there. The reality is that for many of these hunted species, habitat is set aside for them, habitat is managed for them, people take notice of them, particularly the hunting community that provides a fair bit of revenue for this practice. And all of a sudden, for many of these wildlife species, the problems are not one of scarcity, but one of overabundance that even the hunters can't seem to get a handle on. I guess I'd add bears to the list in Wisconsin now. And as far as the trapping side, coyotes, people have been after those animals with every means of control known to human beings, some of them illegal and unethical and whatnot, and coyotes continue to be very abundant and spread far and wide. Beaver problems, same difficulty. So, and then there are, of course, another suite of species like gray squirrels and cottontail rabbits and rough grouse and so forth that are completely unaffected. So some of the argument, I understand the resource user conflict, but the notion that these animals for other people to see or enjoy or watch or whatever are going to be taken off the landscape is simply not true.
Mm-hmm. Let's turn to, thanks, Patricia. Let's turn to William in Sun Prairie next. Hi, William.
Hi. You know, I'd like to mention three critters that are responsible for the low number of deer up north. Bald eagles, they get the young calves. Bears, they get a lot of young deer. And wolves. Now, my dad and I, we went in some of these deer yards in the wintertime, and the wolves will be in there. When we go in May, stink. The deer were there, dead, but not fully eaten. And you mentioned literature. Here's this meat. She's talking about one wolf will get about 20 deer a year. He never, never in the literature, and nowhere in the literature will you ever get see where they, people like my dad, I was born in the 30s, he was born long before that, where we would go into these yards, he never mentioned it, you, Scott Craven, you've never gone in these yards, you have to hold your nose.
Well, Scott, have you ever been in one of those yards?
Yeah, I think I have a time or two roamed around. And the issue, you know, the problem with this issue of predation and wolves and so forth is that there's no clear logical endpoint where everybody's going to come together and say, well, you know, we'd like to have 312 wolves in the state, and as long as they're right over here, everything's square and so forth. But that's not going to happen. Most of these wildlife issues, whether it's deer management or wolf management or, you know, pick your poison, are grossly complicated by all sorts of elements of human nature and human behavior, not to mention the habitat, the animals themselves, disease issues like CWD. It is very complicated. And that's one of the reasons why I wish Dr. Kroll and his crew well. But for folks from out of state, getting their first exposure to deer management in Wisconsin, those guys have their work cut out for
them.
So it is very complicated. And when you add the additional element of emotion and a long history with something like wolves, it's kind of difficult to wrap your mind around.
Yeah, absolutely. Scott Craven, UW Extension Wildlife Ecologist, our guest here. I'm Larry Mueller on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Scott Craven, UW Wildlife Ecologist, talking the wonderful world of Wisconsin wildlife with him today. Join in with your questions at 1-800-642-1234. Go to my Facebook page, too. Post some photos. We've been talking about the many photos that we've been looking at today that have already been posted. Love to see them, and I hope you'll take a look at them, too. And the Facebook page is just at the Larry Mueller Show, so just go there. Or you can email us at talk@wpr.org. We have a Facebook comment from Joe, and this relates to how smart these bucks and older deer can be. He says, my friend took a monster buck only because as he was walking through the woods, he noticed his boot was untied. He turned around to a fallen tree he had just went over to find the deer completely stretched flat. The deer then had to jump up and try to run. That was near Duran, Wisconsin.
Well, you know, assuming, I think we make the assumption here that the deer wasn't in some way injured or sick, but I wouldn't be at all surprised that the deer was perfectly healthy and was just lying low there. The hunter had already gone by. The deer was fine, safe, and he probably took a hoof and wiped his brow and said, well, that was a close one. And then lo and behold, the guy turns around to tie his shoe and, uh-oh.
Yeah.
Got to move. They and many animals, it you hate to be anthropomorphic about them being, you know, smart or thinking this through, but they have escape behaviors that are finely honed over a few years in the woods as the animals get older, and they are quite capable of taking care of themselves. I mean, a better example for me this time of year is hunting pheasants.
Yeah.
Now, people are often critical of raising pheasants in pens, as we do at the State Game Farm, and, you know, putting them out where it's like shooting fish in a barrel.
It isn't.
Anything but. It is amazing how those birds that are raised with thousands of compatriots in a pen put out on the landscape within, well, I mean, literally minutes to hours to the next day or whatever, are able to evade a dog, to run, avoid flying, use cover, head for the best possible cover. It really is hard. It's hard. It's downright hard to believe. But they are very capable of taking care of themselves. We stress that with our student, when we take our student hunting class out, and they're kind of reluctant to think, well, gee, we're going to a game farm or these birds were in a pen a couple days ago. To a person, I mean, they quickly, when we talk with them after a hunting experience, they say, wow, that's amazing. And it is.
Joan in Rudolph, Wisconsin, we turn to you. Hi, Joan.
Hi, thanks for taking the call. When we speak of health of the deer population or any animal out there, isn't it better to have natural predators that are actually culling out the weaker of the animal versus the unnatural predators in the form of hunters taking out the best of the wildlife? Isn't there, or shouldn't there be a natural predation process, like the best will survive versus taking the best out?
Mm-hmm. All right.
Well, absolutely. And what we're actually, I think the best situation and what wildlife managers strive for is a balance of that it isn't all hunting and it isn't all predators. It is a balance between the two. But as we've just been discussing with the ability of some of these animals, the best of the best, as you suggest, they are not especially vulnerable to hunting. Some are eventually killed, as with some of these large bucks that people have been telling us about. But for the most part, they are quite capable of taking care of themselves. And in addition, in terms of the predators, while the party line, so to speak, is that, well, they prey on the weak and the old and the sick and so forth, in reality, there are numbers of animals taken by predators that are perfectly healthy and in some cases even in their prime, or the predation that we're concerned about in the case of deer is with vulnerable fawns that, given the opportunity to survive to a couple weeks of age, are also pretty capable of taking care of themselves. So, no, you're absolutely right, though. It's a situation where everybody's in the mix, and, I mean, some could argue that human predators, i.e. hunters, are just another part of the predator complex. We just have some skills and abilities as humans that other animals
don't. Mm. And we're going to – thank you, Joan, for calling. I appreciate your call. I want to give Dick and Dousman a chance to get in here. Dick, hi.
Good morning. I'm calling about some wood duck houses I put up every fall. I put them up on about 30 acres of nice wetland. There's a couple potholes out there. And I clean them out every year. And last week I went out and cleaned them out. And it's really disturbing, the few that hatched out. One had 20 unhatched eggs in it. One had 11. One had 10. A couple had been taken over by squirrels and had no evidence that there'd been any ducks there. And one had some egg debris. I estimated maybe two or three hatched out of that nest.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm just, you know, very concerned. Last fall, excuse me, it wasn't quite that bad. And on our pond here, we always see wood ducks in the spring, and we always see mergansers. Now, I'm just concerned that, like the one that had 20 eggs in it, that the female wood duck just maybe left if the merganser had been dumping eggs in there. But can you give me an idea what might be going on there?
Well, I can certainly see where you'd be a little discouraged. That's, I think, if I was writing down here correctly, in a relatively few boxes, you found over 40 eggs that had no evidence that they ever hatched.
Yes.
Is that right?
Yes.
Yeah. Well, did you are you kind of watching throughout the season to see what the wood duck behavior is? Is there any disturbance, any predation of the adults, or anything else that you've seen that might shed any light on it?
I've not seen that, and we have a very good view from our house of one of the ponds, and you know, the ducks are coming and going. It's fun to watch them during the courting period, and
Are the houses on posts over water?
The ones that we can see, one's in a big oak tree, one's right on the shore of a pond. A couple are out into the on cattails, 10, 15 yards from shore. And so there's a different variety of where we put them.
But did you notice any of the eggs or the boxes that had eggs that didn't hatch? Did those seem to be ones that were on trees or on dry land or over water or no pattern?
The one that had 20 in them was right 10 feet out into on a pond and on a metal post. And the other one that had 11 was situated in a similar spot.
Right. Well, the one with 20, I mean, that's too large for single clutch, as you know. So that's likely a dump nest that was either multiple females or the merganser joining in the egg-laying frenzy, as you described. And that might explain that one. But I'm not sure what to say here. There are lots of possible explanations, but there are lots of wood duck boxes put up. Of course, wood duck boxes are credited with being the one thing that brought the wood duck back from, you know, almost lost decades ago. So there are lots of people out there doing it. My suggestion would be that you, wherever you live, contact a local sportsman's club or go through the DNR office to see what clubs are around and find some other folks nearby who are running wood duck boxes and see if they're having similar experiences and can shed any light on what's going on.
Mm-hmm. I was concerned. I clean them out and I put fresh straw in every year. Could that be an issue or not?
I wouldn't think so. No. Although you might want to just anything you can control. If you think that might be an issue, you know, switch from straw to wood shavings or something like that, and see if you can make a difference. Make sure your house design, that you have predator guards on there, that the ventilation holes are right and that kind of thing. Anything you can control, try it. But there are certainly other things ranging from a bad year for black flies to weather conditions to a particularly stealthy raccoon to a lot of other things that you can't control that may have had bearing on this bad year. But I'd start out by checking with some other folks around your area to see what their experiences have been and what they might be doing a little differently. There's also a really good DVD that you might be able to find on the internet called The Wood Duck Story that came out a couple of years ago. A fellow here in Wisconsin put it together and sent me a couple of copies of it, and it's really, really cool to see some of the video if you enjoy watching the ducks. And there's a lot of discussion in there about duck box management, so that might help out a little bit too.
There you go. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. We have, lots of callers online. Let's go take Bill in Gays Mills. Bill, hello. Thank you for calling.
Good morning.
What's on your mind?
Just want to talk about sighting of a loggerhead shrike.
Oh, cool.
Three times. I've seen the bird, and I'm going to say I've seen three birds three times. Two of them were probably the same bird. The third one was probably a different bird. The reason I say that is because the first bird I sighted was not very far from my house, and then about 4 days later I sighted another bird about 3 miles from the first sighting. And then about a week and a half later I saw a third bird about 9 miles south of where I saw the second sighting. Now, I don't know whether it was the same bird three times, or three different birds, or two different birds. But there were three sightings, and they were all loggerhead shrike, and very definite as to what they were.
Cool. Well, they're a distinctive bird. They're kind of not commonly seen, but neat to see when you do see them. So that's pretty interesting.
Wisconsin.
Well, thanks for Thanks for passing that along. It's a good segue into something else we wanted to mention. Yeah. I'll just say quickly
that
the Christmas bird counts
got underway today. Yeah.
And there's kind of a window here. A lot of the Wisconsin counts will be the Saturday before this coming Saturday, the Saturday before Christmas, unless it happens to be Christmas Eve as it is this year. If you're interested in the Christmas bird count, there are coordinators in various areas where the counts are centered, communities, counties, and so forth. It's kind of a neat thing. It's a huge public effort to get out there and count. You can also just report in by phone what you're seeing in your backyard. Don't even have to leave the house. All sorts of ways to contribute. And then in addition, with the feeding season coming online big time, Project Feeder Watch, which is run nationally through the Cornell Lab for Ornithology, you can find out about that online and join that system of providing information on what you're seeing at your feeders. So much like Bill reporting the loggerhead shrike, it's those rare birds that really get the birders' blood flowing. So
absolutely
participate in some of these counts and inventories, and then the rare birds make the list, and other people know they're around. So
yeah, absolutely. Scott Craven, UW Extension Wildlife Ecologist, our guest today. He'll be with us right up until 12:30 here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. No doubt that winter is creeping up on us, and the wildlife is even more aware of that, I think, than we are. What are they doing to get ready for winter? Larry Mueller here. Thanks for joining us on the Ideas Network. Happy to have you along today. Lucky to have wildlife ecologist Scott Craven as our guide to the outdoors until 12:30. Do you have a question about Wisconsin wildlife? You're wondering about and maybe an interesting animal behavior you observed, or maybe you've spotted some critters in your garden or house and you're hoping to send them on their way. That's another thing that sometimes happens. Well, whatever your question, join in. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234. You can also email us at talk@wpr.org. And I hope you'll visit our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. Click like when you're there to get regular updates on upcoming show topics. So that's at The Larry Mueller Show. And we'll be back right after this look at the news. Looking at the world of wildlife today with Scott Craven, UW wildlife ecologist. Larry Mueller here. Thank you so much for listening in. And last we can talk about, you can join in with your question. Maybe you've have an unusual sighting. Maybe you've got questions or somebody's got a possible solution to the wood duck issue. We can hear about that. We can hear what you have to say. Maybe you've got some good Christmas ideas for outdoors people. Give us a call, 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org. And Scott, I know you have some Christmas ideas for folks who are still got some shopping to do.
Yes, and dead deer are not on the list. We need to get away from this deer stuff. Let's see what we've got here. The possibilities for someone who's interested in the outdoors, wildlife, are almost endless, but there are some pretty neat categories, I think, that if you haven't thought about, hopefully as I run down the list here, it will something will float your boat and you'll rush out there. But there's just a ton of stuff. I would start out with high on my list for people who are curious about the outdoors, from kids to senior citizens, field guides. There are lots of them. On mammals, birds, reptiles, amphibians, butterflies, everything you could think of. And some are targeted at a youth audience. The ever-popular Peterson Field Guide series targeted to just about anybody who wants to look something up. We usually mention the two field guides to Animal or Wildlife Sign, the two books by Mark Elbrock.
Good books.
Mammal Tracks and Sign, Bird Tracks and Sign. Great books to interpret the kinds of things like that photograph we were puzzling over a few minutes ago with a shredded tree.
Yep.
They're beautifully illustrated. They can help you figure out most of the things you see in the outdoors. So those are a good starting point. On previous programs, we've talked about the popularity of bird feeding and the high cost right now of popular seeds like black oil sunflower. Feeders, always a good bet. Birdhouses, pre-made or instructions or kits or building materials. And I think particularly now with the cost of bird seed for senior citizens, maybe who enjoy feeding the birds or seeing the birds, mm-hmm. but maybe they're on a tight budget. Hey, bag of sunflower seed is a great gift to keep that feeding operation going. So there are lots of things there. We've talked a little bit about the growing popularity of these remotely triggered cameras, trail cameras. They're not just for scouting deer. Just putting them out in the backyard or in the case of something like that, hey, something's beating up this tree and we don't know what it is. Put up the trail camera mm-hmm. and you'll catch the culprit in the act and all the uncertainty is taken away. So they're useful for solving all sorts of outdoor mysteries. And there are many of them available in a wide range of prices and capabilities. Optic equipment of all kinds. There are all sorts of things. If you like seeing these things, human vision is notoriously poor. But we've come up with all sorts of fantastic binoculars, spotting scopes, and other optical equipment to compensate for that lousy vision. Excuse me. Many choices there.
GPS.
GPS units. All sorts of other technical stuff. You know, some things that have come out recently, apps for smartphones. There's one being developed by one of our colleagues here on campus for identifying bird calls on a smartphone app. The Thermocell that came out a few years ago. Yeah, a little gadget that you lug around to keep the mosquitoes away, and it works. all sorts of things like that. Maybe we need to remember with some of those things Leopold's thoughts on that matter, where he hypothesized that the quality of an outdoor experience is inversely proportional to the amount of gadgetry involved in the experience. So some of it's not necessary, but some of it's pretty darn cool. All sorts of, for someone who enjoys wildlife, beyond what you see outside, you can bring things into your home. Wildlife art. There are fantastic wildlife artists, fantastic wildlife photographers. So there are sculptors. All forms of art media capitalize on wildlife in a big way. There are all sorts of neat memberships out there. All kinds of organizations that are interested in a particular species or some aspect of a particular species, as well as donations and other people's names to things like the Vila Zoo here in Madison, the Endangered Resources Fund. There's now a program within the Wisconsin Bat Program with all the hassles mm-hmm. that bats are facing.
Yep.
There are ways to donate to an endowment to help manage bats in the state. There are adopt-an-animal programs in somebody's name, you know, animals from all over the world that you can find on the internet. If you get to outdoor gear, I mean, I hardly know where to begin, but I think focusing on things that everybody can use to better enjoy the outdoors, good rain gear, footwear, gloves, hats, the kinds of things that really keep people comfortable outdoors. And one of the big changes over the last few years in outdoor gear is, I guess for lack of a better term, I'll call it the pink movement. You know, particularly for women and for kids, for a long time it was hard to get stuff that fit or that worked. But that's absolutely not the case. And the reason I use pink is because for kids now, for girls, you can get everything from pink Daisy BB guns to pink fishing tackle to pink clothing of any kind. Now, it doesn't have to be pink, but the important thing is that it's available now for kids and for women who enjoy the outdoors and wildlife. You know, you and I are interested in the outdoor cooking arena. Yeah. Fantastic cookbooks, all kinds of them available, and give people new ideas on how to better enjoy the things that they harvest from the outdoors, whether it's fruits and nuts or fish and game. A Dutch oven. You know, I was in teaching some bow programs over the last year or so. I was exposed to a couple of classes just biding my time on Dutch oven cooking. Holy cow, you can cook some pretty neat stuff in those
absolutely.
Things. And it's fun. Or an open fire grill or all the different spice mixes and marinades that are available now for stocking stuffers. A state parking steak. Let me untie my tongue here from my incisor tooth. State park admission sticker. You know, whole year of enjoyment at our state parks. The state nurseries are in on the act now. You can give a gift of green, a packet of 300 trees or wildlife shrubs available from the state nurseries. You know, we could go on, and but let's break through. Maybe some of the callers have good ideas of something their outdoor enthusiast in the family has really enjoyed over time. But there's just a lot of really neat stuff out there.
A huge amount. In fact, I should mention Giorgio Pellegrini has a new book out. It's called Girl Hunter, Revolutionizing the Way We Eat One Hunt at a Time. And so she doesn't come from a long line of hunters, never even held a gun until recently, but she graduated from the French Culinary Institute. She worked at the famed Blue Hill at Stone Barns, where she actually shot her first turkey. And that experience forever changed her. So she will be on the show on January 5th, and we have that book, so it's one thing. And you mentioned state parks, and I did want to bring up the fact that New Year's Day, and now this is a bit ahead, but, you know, we usually plan what we're going to be doing on, you know, those kinds of holidays. And 8 Wisconsin state parks are inviting the public to New Year's Day hikes. So they're going to be set up hikes at many of our state parks, 8 of them, Chippewa Moraine State Recreation Area, Council Grounds, Devil's Lake, Harrington Beach, High Cliff, Lapham, Mirror Lake, and Peninsula, all great parks. And they're events with naturalists and so forth. So you can go out and get a great hike and in one of our great state parks. Perfect way to spend a New Year's Day.
Sounds like fun. And I just noticed a couple of things I had scribbled down in the corner here that I thought were a good idea. Everybody could use a good pocket knife.
Yeah.
And the neat thing about them is you have them engraved, you know, with the date or some wish, you know, good woodsmanship have whatever. A good pocket knife is a nice gift, and you can get some very nice ones. And, of course, in the absence of something specific, the gift certificates or gift cards are always possible. And anybody who can't find something that they would like at either Gander or Cabela's or Bass Pro is probably not reading the catalogs. So, or even, how about a gift card at the local bait shop for the fisher person in your group? Boy, you can go down with your bait card and get a bucket of minnows and not have to shell out a few bucks. There's all sorts of stuff out there. Think creatively. You'll have a good time.
Well, Julie had an idea, emailed us. A good gift would be Seal Line E-Case, which features tough, transparent urethane windows that can withstand submersion in up to 1 meter of water for 30 minutes. Great way to save your cell phone when it falls into the stream.
Well, good idea.
I like that. And we had an idea from Dean in New London. I'm retired, have everything I need, and request my gifts be donated to the Mosquito Hill Nature Center here in New London, where I volunteer.
Well, there you go. So add to the donation situation all of our many great nature centers around the state. Wildlife rehabilitation centers there are a lot of them around the state. They're always looking for help to feed orphaned and injured and sick wildlife that needs some help. If you think about all the different things we talk about on the program and then figure out an angle on how you can help, there are lots and lots of ways to do it.
Yeah, absolutely. A caller from Appleton, by the way, thinks that photo of Bernie's destroyed tree shows the work of a pileated or pileated woodpecker.
Well,
it's pretty low.
That's not problematic. I mean, I've seen them work right at ground level so that their tail is almost braced on the ground. And that would have been my guess, the smooth side. It may have been just where they hammered it away. But a pileated on a dead snag can create, I mean, I've seen like bushels of wood chips under a tree. So that's a better possibility than probably a deer.
Carol in Kenosha has a question or comment. Hi, Carol.
Hi, Larry and Scott. I had a delightful encounter in the city with wildlife yesterday. I was visiting a friend, and when I came out to leave, there right in the front yard is this beautiful little fox. And I just stopped and looked at it. He stopped and looked at me. I started talking to him, and he walked around a little bit and then just sat down and looked at me and scratched furiously at the fleas. And it went on for 2-3 minutes. And I just kept talking to him, and he kept looking at me. And finally, there was a spotlight on the ground for holiday decorations. And he just casually walked over and kind of sniffed at this and looked at the light, and then deliberately walked over, crouched right on top, and peed on the light.
Well, that's a neat encounter, Carol. Thanks for sharing it with us. And if you enjoyed that, then you should get the last issue of Wisconsin's DNR's Natural Resources Magazine.
Oh, yes.
There's an interesting story in there about another individual's encounter with a family of fox, and I think you'd really enjoy it. And there's some pictures as well. And on that subject, since we were talking about gifts, I'd add two more things. If you really want to stay in the loop on what's going on around the state with research, with the various seasons, with just observations, Outdoor News, the newspaper format, biweekly thing, will keep you up to date as much as anything else, and the subscriptions are reasonably priced. And then the DNR's Natural Resources Magazine, same thing, monthly publication. So either one of those, a relatively inexpensive way to keep people informed on opportunities and things that are going on outdoors.
There you go. Thank you very much, Carol, for calling. Appreciate your call. Judy in Dousman has a comment or question. Hi, Judy.
Hi. I have two items. Number one, is it possible that a deer would breed with a llama?
I'm going to say no, but do you have other information to suggest otherwise?
The winter before last, there was what we thought was a deer, was born probably a good 2.5 months or more after the normal delivery of the deer, and it maintained its spots into winter, and it had the face of a llama. It did not grow to full size, and we ended up calling it Baby, and it was very friendly. And in the morning when I'd go to feed the turkeys, I would call Baby, and she'd come down the pathway with 9 or 10 other deer following her. She became almost the mascot or leader of the pack. And
my guess is that it was a late fawn. The 2.5 months is unusual, but the distribution of fawn births is a normal distribution. I've had reports over the years. I had one where there were fawns born in April, and equally, you know, going out on the other end into early fall. So my guess is it was a late fawn. And just looked out of place at that time of year, but it's also possible that there was some anomaly with it in terms of who knows what. But I think that the llama deer cross is probably out of the question.
Probably out of the question. It just, there could have been just some damage to the.
So what's number two, Judy?
Number two is a number of years back, we had a duck that was sitting on our back hill and sat there from morning until late afternoon, and then one of our little dogs got hit out front by a car. So my husband went out back to dig a little burial site for it, and in between time, he had dug the hole, and there were 4 little baby ducks that had obviously been killed by a fox or coyote. He put those in the hole and came back for the dog in the garage, and by the time he went back, those ducklings were gone. Now, would it have been the fox or the wolf feeding it? It was early in the season. Have taken those ducklings out of that hole to feed its...
Well, I mean, there are dozens of animals that might have passed by and snatched up those ducklings, but I would say that if it happened that quickly in broad daylight, it was most likely a crow or something like that, and they would have snatched them up in a heartbeat and just carried them away. So it could have been a fox. It could have been a squirrel, for that matter. A whole host of other things that either just opportunistically, whoa, a hole with some ducklings in it. It looks like dinner. But I'd say that the likelihood of something passing overhead and seeing those, like a crow or even a turkey vulture, would have been greater than a mammal on the ground. Mm-hmm. So
there we go. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. And Wendell and Marinette, your turn. Hi, Wendell.
Hello. I have two things. One quick comment just to say, as a hunter, I really enjoy the fact that wolves are increasingly on our Wisconsin landscape, and I think that actually the deer of Wisconsin belong to everyone, hunters and non-hunters. But the question I have regarding sort of research is, in our area, we're seeing a real resurgence of turkey populations, and as somebody that's interested in reptiles and amphibians, I wonder if any research is going on to look at turkey impact on these reptiles and amphibians.
Well, the turkey population did boom for quite a long time, but there seems to be some evidence that it's retrenching leveling off a bit. But that doesn't mean there still aren't a lot of turkeys, and in places where we didn't think there would be. And given the opportunity, a small snake like a smooth green snake or a red-bellied snake or a decayed snake is just a tasty little snack for a foraging turkey. And they're pretty efficient foragers, scratching in the forest floor and whatnot. So I think it is possible that there are, whether they're population-level impacts or not on reptile populations, they certainly are consumed by turkeys. That would include salamanders, a frog if they could catch it, the smaller snakes, some of our more unusual lizards. But as far as I know, other than some anecdotal account that people have either seen this or speculate that it happens, I don't know of anyone actually working on the population level impacts. But it's an interesting idea.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much for calling. And Frank in Rothschild. Hi, Frank.
Yes, me and my wife go for car rides in the area here, and we saw a white, what appeared to be, after some research, an albino red hawk.
We had thought
red tail that we thought maybe a first really gear falcon, but that thought maybe, well, they don't belong in the area, and maybe it was a little large. I saw it a couple of times, about a week apart, and then we haven't seen it since. Are those relatively common, or do you think that's what it might have been? It wasn't big enough to be like an albino eagle.
And it seemed snow white. It wasn't just a pale one. It was
no, this was white. I mean, it stuck out like a sore thumb.
Well, we get lots of calls on this. We've had a couple today about a white goose and a white hawk and
a white deer
and a white deer. I mean, albinism does occur, and there are other conditions: piebald albinism, leucistic animals which are not albinos but can be white or pale. So it does happen. It's never common. And it's a curiosity that attracts people's attention. So it's a neat sighting. Pictures are always welcome of such a thing, so we can try and verify the species and so forth. All I can tell you is that there are records of most animals having white individuals, and it's not particularly common.
Hmm. Okay. All right. Thank you very much.
Thanks very much for calling. Appreciate your call. And Scott, I know the DNR is taking submissions, wanted to mention this, for an online fish cookbook and also surveying the fish-eating habits of Wisconsin folks who do fish, and they're also using it as a way to get advice on fish consumption and contaminants out to people that need it. So we put a link up on my Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show for that, so if people want to get some more information or submit a fish recipe.
That's an easy one for me. Slap them in a beer batter and some hot oil and serve them with a cold beer. End of story.
That's as good a way as there is, isn't it? To have fish. And I tell you what, there's nothing. And this time of year, we were just Gary Engberg was on the other day, and we were talking about ice fishing, and it's for my money, too dangerous to be out there yet, at least in southern Wisconsin. But there's nothing like some fish caught through the ice, taken back.
Take them home, and they don't get any fresher than that. And, there are lots. I didn't mean to belittle the many recipes. And there are some fish species, like salmon, for example, that deep fried, that doesn't cut it. But There are lots of good fish recipes. That'll make for an interesting book.
Yeah, it really will. And thank you so much for coming by today. Appreciate it.
My pleasure.
You'll
Happy
be back
holidays.
In action in a couple of weeks.
Fourth of January. So by then, everyone will have had a happy holiday, and I hope some of these gift ideas are found under the holiday tree.
Scott Craven, wildlife ecologist, our guest. He'll be back on January 4th, just in a couple of weeks. A couple of months for tax day, and we'll talk taxes tomorrow.